From the Lend Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the first day of July 2016. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. And stay with us if you can, because Mike joined us on yesterday's recording of Commodity Week. That's up online already at WILLAG.org in its entirety. Our other panelists for that program included Kevin Van Trump of the Van Trump Report, Pete Manhart of Bates Commodities, along with Greg Johnson of the Andersons. A really good listen. You can stay with us, and you'll probably hear that today on most of these radio stations. Otherwise, pick it up online at willag.org, W-I-L-L-A-G.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Here's the way the numbers finished in Chicago on this Friday afternoon. July corn down 5 3/4 at $3.53. December 367, 4 1/4 lower. July of next year, 3 1/2 lower at $3.85 3/4. July beans down 6 1/4, $11.68 3/4. November at $11.37 1/2, 15 3/4 lower in next year's. January at $11.33 down 15 1/4. Bean oil 35 cents lower. Bean meal down 50 cents. Wheat futures soft red down 15 at $4.16 1/4, and the hard red down a dime at $3.94 1/4. Live cattle future, now that the Julys have gone off the board, August contract at $112.97 1/2, down $1.85. August feeders at $142.25, $2 and a nickel lower, and lean hogs down 25 cents at $82.60 in the July. August 83.87 1/2, up 60 cents. You're listening to the closing market report from Illinois Public Media on this Friday afternoon. It is the first day of July. Just a quick reminder that Monday is the Independence Day or July 4th holiday. The markets will be closed. Running of Commodity Week on that day here on the closing market report. Markets will open again on Tuesday morning at 8:30 a.m. Now, on the line with us to take a look at what happened in Chicago today is Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Great to be with you again, Todd.
How have things changed in the last 24 hours in your world?
Oh, I think probably the biggest feature since the reports have come out is the issue. By and large, all the calls today were about, are we ever going to get a chance to get close to $4 again in new crop corn futures? And I think that brings up the issue of what we dealt with earlier this year before we ran up to those two-year highs in corn and beans about getting the 2016 marketed at a profit so that we can come through 2016 strong enough to not have to worry about 2017. 2017 now, I think, is in the at least the back part of the producers' minds again, and in some cases in the front part of producers' minds again. So the upside potential in corn was probably 90% of the conversations I've had since the USDA acreage and stocks reports.
Yeah, so really we have a 20-cent difference between D16 and D18 as it relates to what the price might be. What were you able to tell them?
I think you're probably looking at we've had a very strong trading range band since the lows were put in place in 2014 at around 320. And keep in mind, we were coming off of that $5 level in 2014 in June. And so we had that super big break in the markets. Once we had that low carved out, we have not wanted to go below that 340 to 345 level in lead month futures. And that seems to be a good level of support. I think that's probably the bottom of the barrel unless we see the wheat market want to go below $4. And this is a timely topic because it was just reported today that Mashoffs came out today and reported through Reuters that they were now buying wheat to feed their hogs. So we are now in the situation, and we talked about this on Commodity Week, where wheat is back as a chain around the neck of corn and taking up some feed demand. I don't think it's as much as the USDA thought in the June stocks report, but it is starting to be a feature now.
All right. So where do we head to now?
I think that the big thing now is next week we get crop conditions. If I had to say the biggest difference between corn and beans in the trade's mind, other than their continued belief that the demand in beans is not going to waver because there's no competition like wheat is for corn, I think, Todd, it goes back to the crop conditions. We continue to see the crop conditions go up in corn, go down slightly in beans, And therefore, the corn market, I think, is really in tune with the idea that we're trading a 2014 yield. We're believing there's a 2014 yield out there in terms of what the price looks at right now. So we had a 171 national average yield in 2014. Our good to excellent corn crop conditions at 75% are identical to what they were going into July 4th of 2014. This is where on Tuesday's crop conditions report and what the weather models actually show, or what the radar maps actually show versus what the weather models are predicting right now, these are the two biggest features to being able to get the corn back up. I think that based upon the strong demand in corn, if the beans don't give up here and fall sharply, that the corn needs to go back up closer to the 385, 395 level one more time in the December corn futures, with or without a weather market. I think it will do that either right before harvest or as we get into harvest. So that's what I'm kind of planning on in the marketing plan. Now, if we take out 368, 367 next week when we come back and we take those March 31 lows out in December corn, I will slip into some September corn puts to protect another 20, 25 cent slip in prices. But I don't want to really recommend any cash sales here, because I do think there's a window of opportunity at least one more time to get back up to that 385 to 395 level in these futures.
I want to come back to the comment you made about the mash offs. I've got that in the agricultural news segment coming up as well. However, how important is it that they're an Illinois based company? And that if they're talking about this, they're probably not only feeding hard red winter wheat in some of their production areas to the west, but that here in the state of Illinois, they may very well be feeding soft red winter wheat.
It's extremely important. I'm glad you bring this up, because the spread between soft red winter wheat versus corn in the lead month futures has not been negative corn up until just this past week or so. We've been trading above 75 cents. That's typically an area that keeps wheat out of the feed ration in the soft red wheat. Now, you're right. The hard red wheat has been a factor in the livestock rations probably for about a month now, maybe less, a little less than that, because the basis is so wide in the hard red wheat. But with soft red wheat having actually a positive basis in locations of Indiana and Illinois, it wasn't up until this week that it became an issue, because that spread stayed around 75 cents in the futures. Now that we're trading back into the mid to lower 60 cent region, it does become a bigger competitor. So this is where the two things we need right now for a corn market low are declining crop conditions in the reports by USDA, because I think that brings back the fund mindset. We better cover our shorts in corn. Maybe it isn't a 2014 crop. The second thing we need is simply what we've needed for the last 2 years almost, and that is a low in the wheat market. And International Grains Council started the trend this morning with coming out with world wheat production identical to what USDA gave us in the June report. And then we had this mash off story, and we noted that soft red wheat was the leader to the downside, down 4% on the session.
How soon do you think we can put a low in?
I was looking at some of the December wheat charts before I headed out for the road trip that we're taking back to Indiana and Illinois right now. And I think that you're probably going to get something developed after the July report, because several years, like 2010, was one of those years where after the July report, we seemed to find a really nice bottom and low in the July, in the December wheat futures. If we don't get it then, Todd, we may have to stick it all the way out to September. But I'll have more on that next week when I get back and do a little bit more longer term research.
By report, you mean the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates?
That's right, sir.
All right. So we'll have to look forward to that and see where that one goes. What did you tell producers today when you were playing, I suppose, the shoulder that they cried on and opportunities that they may yet have? Is it all about July weather?
I think probably 75% of it is about July weather, because then you've got to change your marketing plan relatively quickly. And I want to say it is very good that they are calling and they are communicating. You want that in a client and a subscriber. You want them to keep the channel of communication wide open so that they don't let it get to them too much. And that's the key during these time periods. But I think the biggest thing that I talk to them about, I won't fight USDA on the acreage number. I'll leave that alone. I'll play the yield and the demand side for 16, 17 corn to make my case why we should get back up towards $4 again. What I will say, though, is the grain stocks report does not make any sense. And I think it really helped me a lot to do Commodity Week this week and have someone like Greg Johnson from the Andersons on talking about the cash grain. It helped me a lot to talk to other commercials around the Central Corn Belt saying and suggesting they don't have the corn supplies they had last year. So it really calls into question whether the stocks are out there. And we should start to see that relatively soon in the cash basis, especially with this break in prices in the futures market. So that's something else, probably the third leg of the stool to watch next week is, do we see a spike in the basis because farmers have shut the bin doors again?
Hey, one quick note there, Greg, and those folks who listen will probably hear him say it may have been that all that livestock went on a diet. As he has, I think that's his quote from Commodity Week as it relates to the grain stocks numbers. However, with the news out of Mashoff today, I suppose that could be part of the replacement there.
I think very little, because I think, like I said, Todd, I don't think that the USDA report would have captured that this would have taken effect when the USDA was capturing these numbers. I still think that the off-farm storage of corn seems quite a bit high. Off-farm storage of corn seems quite a bit high, in my opinion, in relation to last year. And I would say the other thing that farmers need to know is that if you look at a price model like I utilize at $3.50 July corn, we're already banking on, in my opinion, a 2.2 to 2.3 billion bushel carryover. So that takes pressure off me to say, oh, we got to sell cash because of this weather. If it rains, we got to sell cash. I don't believe that, because I think a lot of this rain has been already priced into the market. So that's why I'm more of a put buyer in the short term for a 20 or 25 cent price break.
Hey, thanks so much for taking the time with me today.
Hey, happy 4th of July, and thank goodness we got this country of ours.
All right. I appreciate you and all the work you do. That, of course, is Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. In today's agricultural news, despite years of lobbying and pressure from food and agricultural groups, Vermont's GMO labeling law took effect today. However, that law may be very short-lived. Wednesday of next week brings a cloture vote in the U.S. Senate on a compromise bill that would preempt state laws and make GMO labeling mandatory across the nation. In a test vote this week, senators backed moving ahead with the measure 68-29. Votes could change when the bill comes up for the cloture and then a vote on final passage. While as expected, Vermont senators oppose the bill, Farm State Democrats largely support the Robert Stabenow Compromise. Well, Britain's decision last month to leave the European Union could have both market and trade policy effects on the U.S. grain industry. That, according to the U.S. Grains Council, it says exactly how that change could impact farmers' bottom lines is among the many questions. The EU does not import large volumes of U.S. corn due to trade barriers related to biotechnology. Overall, the total value of all types of U.S. feed grains and related products that were exported in 2014-15 were about $745 million. Though the initial grain market impact eased quickly, USGC says following-on effects on exports could be seen from a stronger U.S. dollar. Markets might also face negative impacts from Brexit on the euro area and, to a lesser extent, the global economy, affecting demand for grain and the meat it produces. However, the largest and longest-term impacts of the Brexit on grains could come from the trade policy arena, not the marketplace. The Grains Council says the vote will put the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, talks between the United States and the European Union in potential jeopardy. And finally today, the Mashoffs. That's a family-owned company right here in the state of Illinois that is the nation's third-largest hog producer, says the plunge in wheat prices has that company using wheat in feed rations. Pro Farmers First Thing Today reports typically hogs eat a mix of around 80% corn and 20% soybean meal, but that mix can vary based on the availability of attractive alternatives like distillers' dried grains. Wheat is normally too expensive to feed to animals, but record-setting yield reports as winter wheat harvest progresses has sent prices lower and made the grain viable as a feed ration. Wheat has higher protein levels than corn, which economists calculate make it the better buy once it is less than 110% the price of corn. The company detailed that wheat can replace around 50% of corn for young pigs and 100% for adult pigs. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at WILLAG.org. Follow us on Twitter at Commodity Week, or look up our Facebook page. Look for WILLAG.org on Facebook. Let's go back now to that first agricultural news story on the GMO labeling law out of Vermont. An American Farm Bureau official says GMO labeling legislation in Washington, D.C., to preempt that kind of patchwork of state labeling laws, has received an unexpected boost this week. More than 100 Nobel laureates are asking Greenpeace in a letter to end its opposition to GMOs, especially golden rice, that could reduce blindness causing vitamin A deficiencies in children in developing countries. The story broke just as the U.S. Senate began moving bipartisan legislation to preempt state GMO labeling laws. American Farm Bureau Executive Director Dale Moore feels the letter to Greenpeace could boost the Senate bill's chances.
When you get over 100 Nobel laureates, not just any group of scientists, but these are folks that have been recognized for, you know, their expertise, for the work that they, you know, contribute to the body of science. And if they're telling folks, Greenpeace and otherwise, that, you know, GMOs are safe, I think I am going to find some way to thank those that had started this process.
In the letter to Greenpeace, the Nobel laureates wrote that scientific and regulatory agencies around the world have repeatedly found biotech foods as safe as or safer than conventional foods, with not a single case of human or animal harm. Moore calls the campaign a clear victory for biotechnology and its role in feeding the world's growing hungry and starving populations.
Virtually anybody would be hard-pressed to accuse scientists who've managed to get recognized as Nobel Prize winners, that they are somehow not independent in their thinking. Otherwise, they wouldn't achieve the breakthroughs in science that they do in their own work. And the fact that they're standing up for this, I think, speaks volumes.
The Nobel laureates charge Greenpeace, quote, deliberately went out of their way to scare people, unquote, to raise money for their cause. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. Have you been to your local county fair this year? There's a pretty good chance that's the case. Did you know in Illinois, the county fairs create about $170 million worth of economic activity? These agricultural celebrations are moneymakers, knitted tightly into the fabric of rural America and its economy. Community and economic development crew at the University of Illinois surveyed fairgoers last summer to get an idea of just how much money they spend and why they go.
Give that ticket to the gentleman right over here.
Entertainment, of course, is high on the list, says Zach Kennedy.
We also found that they were there for anything ranging from doing activities, seeing exhibits. Some folks were there just for the food.
And those folks spend a lot of money. The biggest spenders live in southern Illinois, averaging some $200 a person for the run of the fair. The Northern Illinois fairs, not to be outdone, bring in the most money, almost $100 million. But really, to be honest, going to the fair, well, it's not so much about the money.
The ideas of tradition and unity and educational opportunities rose to the top of some of the things that folks said that the fair meant to them and their family.
The traditions are deep in the social fabric. It's colored with the 4-H clover. The county fair is a time to work hard and play hard with neighbors and friends, and to share those experiences with others. Along the way, in the state of Illinois, the county fairs create 1,000 jobs and something approaching $200 million. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Let's check in now on the agricultural weather forecast. Eric Snodgrass from Agrible joins us. Eric, why don't you tell us a little bit about the month of June and really what it's meant to the price of corn as it's related to the weather across the Corn Belt?
Well, Todd, the past few weeks have been quite volatile for corn futures, and weather has certainly played its part. Let's start with the big picture view of June. It was a very warm month for the Corn Belt, and there was a lot of concern over the heat from June, which was largely actually a good thing for the crop. Will that carry over into July is the big question. Well, we know that cool July temperatures produce the highest yields, so one of the big questions is whether a hot June means a hot July. Well, for Illinois, the correlation is very weak, but it is positive. But this means that we can't really use this as a metric to forecast temperatures for the rest of the month. So it doesn't really matter, though, because in the short term, we have some cooler air that's in place that we've been forecasting now for the last 10 to 12 days. Corn in the southern parts of the belt are already going to tassel, and this cooler weather is actually ideal for the crop. I took a quick crop tour through northern Illinois and Wisconsin, and there is very little stress on the crop in these two areas. The only spots that I saw problems are the spots that have problems even in the best of years. Looking bigger picture, though, the only regions that are not looking great are western Illinois, northern Missouri, parts of southern Iowa, southern Illinois, and Michigan. These areas have been very dry while the crop has had to endure all that heat from June. Well, some of these regions will be in for some serious rain over the next 5 days. Earlier this week on Tuesday, I released a special video highlighting the heavy rains that are forecast for this weekend and early next week. These rains are much different from the thunderstorms that we had 2 weeks ago, in that the rain will be widespread and not scattered. Essentially, a small trough in the jet stream is promoting the development of a low-pressure system that will track across the southern Corn Belt and bring copious amounts of rain to Kansas, Missouri, the southern half of Illinois, southern Indiana, and southern Ohio. Now, the good is easy to see in this, but I want to throw out a couple of things here. The northern edge of this rain is very difficult to predict. If it misses northern Missouri, southern Iowa, and parts of western Illinois, like near Quincy, Illinois, well, these regions will go into July very dry, and we are expecting a return to above 90 temperatures around July 6th, 7th, and 8th. Additionally, parts of Indiana are having trouble with too much water, and this rain is forecast to hit those regions too. So to me, this all points toward more market variability in the short term. So one last thing to add, the ECMWF, which is the European model, has been consistently forecasting another cool down after we warm up at the end of the first week of July. And as I mentioned at the beginning, cooler weather in July is ideal for corn. We could have yet another great crop this year, even with some of the regional stresses that we're discussing. It all depends on how the precipitation plays out over the next 3 to 4 weeks, and if those high temperatures are brief in duration during that same time period.
Hey, thanks, Eric. Eric Snodgrass, of course, is with Agribull, joins us on this July 1st edition of the Closing Market Report. Don't forget that the markets are closed on Monday for the 4th of July holiday. They won't open again until 8:30 a.m. on Tuesday morning. Have a great weekend. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.